Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Heading into election night 2016, the outcome seemed a foregone conclusion. Hillary Clinton had this one in the bag. After all, a cursory look at the polls and at the comments of poll aggregators painted what looked like an obvious picture. But as election night turned into the morning after, one of the biggest upsets in political history unfolded.
CBS News is projecting that once all the votes are counted, Donald Trump will win Ohio. Now, this keeps his hopes alive. CBS News is estimating that Donald Trump will be the winner in North Carolina. CBS News now estimates that Donald Trump will be the winner in Florida.
The election of Donald Trump in the face of those seemingly rock-solid predictions of a Clinton landslide was earth-shattering. Not just because the outcome was so unexpected, but because, from the layman's point of view, our confidence in the wizardry of polls and pollsters was shaken. How could they have gotten this so wrong, many wondered. With the country already knee-deep in polls for 2020, we wonder, do polls still matter? Are they to be trusted as indicators of voter sentiment or of the outcome? Could either side be helped by paying attention to the polls, or would they be better served by ignoring them altogether? Anthony Salvanto can't ignore them. He's the director of elections and surveys for CBS News. In addition to overseeing all the polling for the network, he heads the CBS News Decision Desk, whose job it is to estimate the outcomes on election night. He put the lessons of 2016 in his book, Where Did You Get This Number? A Pollster's Guide to Making Sense of the World. We talked with him about those lessons and whether pollsters, in fact, got it wrong 2 years ago. It was you who put the words in Scott Pelley's mouth a moment ago. You're in for a long night. You told him that, right?
I did. I opened the book with that chapter, and what we saw during the day there as those early exit polls were coming in was that even though there was at the time a slight Clinton lead, it was clear to me anyway that the people who were still voting, the people who were still yet to vote in a lot of those states, looked like they were the sorts of voters who'd been supporting Donald Trump. And so that just profiled to me like it was going to be a tight one, which turned out to be quite correct. One of the things, let me go back to the intro. You said a couple of words that really kind of caught my ear. You said, a cursory look at the polls, and you said predictions. And I'm glad you said that, because one of the things that I'm trying to do in talking to people about how we do polls is to tell folks to go a little bit deeper into what your pollster is telling you, to demand that your pollster tell you a little bit more than the horse race, and also not to treat polls as predictions, but rather treat them as something that can explain the entirety of the world to you. Now, one thing that I always note is that if we had seen, or people had paid attention to, the whole picture, we had described all along in 2016 this set of folks, we called them reluctant Republicans, and they were talking to us in the polls, and I emphasize that, they were talking to us, but some of them said that they were unsure who they would vote for, or unsure if they were going to show up. They were not for Hillary Clinton by any means. And that was keeping then-candidate Trump's poll numbers a little bit lower. Well, if we think about the whole world, we think about this the way a campaign would. If you were running a campaign, you said, well, look, there's these voters out there who profile as potential Trump voters. They're conservative. They support some of the policies that he's espousing. Should we be shocked if at the end of the day they come out and vote for Trump? No, we should not be shocked. And at the same time, you looked over at the Clinton numbers, and if you looked past that horse race, and she was indeed leading in most, if not all, of these states, and you said, well, okay, but Democrats also tell us they're not as enthusiastic as Trump voters. And, should we really expect them all to show up? Well, we do, but should we be shocked if they don't? In fact, on election night, one of the things that we noticed as the night unfolded was in county after county that was heavily Democratic. And, you know, some of that was early when North Carolina closed, was that the Democratic areas weren't showing up in quite the same numbers as the Republican areas. And so that's one place where the polls were, you know, getting their turnout estimates a little bit too high for Democrats. And so you say to yourself, all right, well, are we shocked then that those less enthusiastic Democratic voters didn't show up? Well, you know, maybe a little bit surprised, but certainly not shocked.
So were people not listening to you and people like you?
No. That's not at all what I mean. I mean, we did describe, you know, the possibilities that could happen, or at least we tried to, and the possibilities that Donald Trump could win. Didn't say would, but could. I think that one of the things that happens is that we're all busy. Look, I'm a baseball fan, and I will admit, from time to time, when I don't have time to read the whole sports page, I'll check the standings. And, you know, most times, whoever's leading in the ninth inning of a game or leading in the, you know, down the home stretch of a baseball season, you know, does go on to win. And it's frankly, history shows in polling that the leader very often wins. What's happened is people will look at that top line number and say, okay, you know, the leader is the leader and will probably go on to win. But what I like to say is that just looking at the leader never tells you the entire story. Mm. And if you were carrying forward from history and saying that the leader often wins, what you missed was that this was a very unusual campaign in the sense that both candidates had very high negative personal ratings. And we had not seen a campaign like that. We had not seen a front runner like Hillary Clinton, who had such high negative ratings. And that introduced an element of uncertainty into the race. You could not apply the lessons of the past, where at least one, if not both, of the candidates were liked in the polls, to this one and use the same sort of rubric for figuring out whether or not the leader was going to win. So here again is a lesson. Treat every campaign differently and say, what is the dynamic here?
So stepping back and just looking at this from the 30,000-foot level as a layperson, it was a lot of people's impression that it was going to be a Hillary Clinton landslide. And that, for me at least, was based on looking at the polls. You, however, do this for a living. You are deep in the weeds on polls, and CBS conducts its own polls all the time. I'm curious as to when you knew that that a Donald Trump victory was certainly a possibility, and then when you knew it was probable, because you go into a place on election day, you and other people from other networks called a quarantine room. And you go in there at noon, and you leave your cell phones outside the door, and you're not allowed to leave until 5 o'clock. And you write about this in your book, where all these pollsters and people who are going to run the election desks for the various networks go into this room. If they need to go to the bathroom, they're escorted, because nothing can leak. You're looking at all of the exit polls as they come in from polling places around the country. Mm-hmm. Is that where the picture began to emerge, or did you have a full-fledged view of this before you walked into that room?
I thought it would be close when I was looking at that, because, you know, what you do as a pollster, and this is part of the science of polling, is you're putting together a sample, and you're trying to make that sample look like a microcosm of the whole, right? It should be the nation in miniature, as I think George Gallup used to describe it. Well, if I'm looking at those exit polls, this is happening in real time. People are voting at that time, so I'm getting preliminary data. And if I see that and I'm saying, all right, well, who's left to vote? What am I not seeing yet? And that's the thing a pollster should always be asking. I know what I'm seeing, but what am I not seeing? And is what I'm looking at representative of the whole? Well, at this point, early in the day, that's an incomplete picture because not everyone has voted. And so one of the things I think of is who's still outstanding, who's still left to vote that day. And one of the really sort of compelling parts of that day was that you know, some votes, as you all vote, very very many of your ballots down there are cast early, right? They're cast absentee or in early voting. Mm-hmm. And those ballots were in favor of Hillary Clinton. So a lot of people thought, oh, well, she's got votes in the bank. But on election day, the people who were voting were, it turned out, more for Donald Trump. So here's a case where those first ballots that come out, those first things you're counting, are going one way. But is it representative? Is it the whole? And that's how I have to think. I have to think of what's out there and what's remaining. Even when I bring you a regular poll on a CBS News poll, my job is to put together that whole microcosm so that no piece is missing. Every piece is in its right proportion. So that was the case there, and so that's why I came back early in the evening, and I said, look, this is contested.
That's Anthony Salvanto, Director of Elections and Surveys for CBS News, talking to us about polling and what polls tell us about elections. The conversation continues after this here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Back to our conversation with Anthony Salvanto, head of elections and surveys at CBS News, and author of Where Did You Get This Number? A Pollster's Guide to Making Sense of the World. We talked about elections and polling and the question that has hung over pollsters since Donald Trump's 2016 upset. Did they get it wrong?
A lot of how polls turn out is where we conduct them. Talk about that.
Right. Right. So there wasn't enough polling in the Midwest states that swung the 2016 election. There wasn't enough polling in Wisconsin. There wasn't enough in Michigan. And I certainly count myself among those who I wish I'd gone back and done more polling in Michigan.
Because it was a foregone conclusion in your minds as a pollster that those were going to remain Democratic strongholds?
Well, I wouldn't say foregone conclusion, but we all had some assumptions, and we were leaning on past vote pretty heavily, but also we were following where the campaigns were going.
Okay.
I mean, part of our job is to tell you the story as it unfolds, and, you know, the campaigns were going to Florida, the campaigns were going to Ohio, so I did more polls there, and quite frankly, I did have Ohio moving toward Trump. I didn't get as far towards Trump as it ended up, but I had it moving that way. I had Florida moving toward Trump, and that turned out to be pretty close. And so, you know, that's a case where when I go back and I look at the places in the upper Midwest, I say, okay, what are the lessons I can carry forward here? You know, when we tell you there's a margin of error, that's not a hedge. I see it as a description of something is dynamic and something is potentially changing. And that, you know, if you follow politics in a lot of respects, that's exciting.
Yeah.
I often use this example. If I tell you that, if I tell you 65% of people think the economy is good, very few people quarrel with that. They say, oh, yeah, okay, you know, the economy is good. And by a lot of accounts, it is, of course. But nobody goes, well, wait, it could be 62% of people who think that, or it could be 68% of people who think that. And the reason people don't quarrel is that the margin of error there doesn't change the story, doesn't change what you want to know. But we pollsters, if we start giving you, whether it's a small range of seats or it's a estimate on a 50-50 race, you know, here our ability to be precise, you know, encompasses a couple of different outcomes. And that is something that, you know, we have to accept. That's the amount of precision that we have. It's in one way you could look at it is it's still pretty magical that we can get within 3 points to either side of an estimate with a small sample. But if you must know who the leader is, well, sometimes you just have to wait for election night, Mike.
I want to go back to something you said, I think, before the break about what was emerging as you looked at exit polls and the fact that early voters, people who either precast their votes because they were going to be out of town or they mailed in their ballots or they participated in early voting, voted for Hillary Clinton, whereas people going to the polls on Election Day, many of them who swung this vote to Donald Trump, voted for Donald Trump. And in the book, I think, you talk about late deciders swinging for Donald Trump. people who had not made up their mind until they walked into the booth. And given the news that we've been following recently with regard to influencing the vote with paying off porn stars and other aspects of the last election, do you think that James Comey, for instance, his late decision to reopen the investigation into Hillary, caused these people who've decided in the booth to vote for Trump to do so?
Well, what they told us is that they were deciding on the economy and they were looking for this rather large word we use, which is change. And, you know, one of the things that I note in the book and we noticed is that those late deciders were so heavily for Trump in those upper Midwest states, which is another, you know, one reason why more polling there might have picked more of that up. They were in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, et cetera, Michigan. So, you know, I think that part of that is one of the, you know, the sort of break toward the out party rather than the, right, the incumbent party. And we've seen that in past elections, but just not in those kinds of numbers. And we did see the race tighten as we moved into those final weeks, those final days. I think that, you know, again, the sort of lesson to carry forward for all of this is, let me go back a second where I started to use a sports analogy, because and why I wanted to say that sometimes those are inapt. Here's why. When we talk about a horse race, the campaign horse race, that implies that as those horses gallop along, the furrows that they've crossed are gone and in the books forever, and so the course does in fact narrow. And that makes it harder for whoever's trailing to catch up. Well, in a lot of respects, in a campaign, everything could change in the span of a week. Everything could change in the span of a day, because this is a collective decision that's made in a very short time window. Now, of course, one could argue that some people make up their minds and are firm as they go along. But the fact remains that the thing that counts, the vote, doesn't actually take place until one point of collective decision. And so, you know, you want to look at this as, when you want to say anything can happen, it really is the case. You want to ask your pollster, what's the range of things that can happen?
We're talking to Anthony Salvanto, who's director of elections and surveys for CBS News, as he was in the 2016 election, and the author of a book trying to put all this into perspective and help people understand how to use polls and surveys and what pollsters do, what they look for, and the lessons learned from 2016. Where did you get this number is the name of the book. In this book, you talk about sitting in the green room, waiting to go on CBS this morning, 2 days before the election. And CBS correspondent Major Garrett was in the room with you, and he'd been covering the Trump campaign for months, and he told you 2 days before the election that Trump could win. And that statement came from his being in the room on the campaign trail at these rallies that Donald Trump was having, and watching both the number of people in those rallies and their enthusiasm. And I'm just curious if you had a chance to talk to Nancy Cordes, another CBS correspondent who followed the Hillary Clinton campaign. Did her impressions of that campaign have something exactly opposite? Did she think that Hillary was going to lose?
I didn't get that chance, but okay. I do think though that we want to look at a larger context here. And, you know, after the election, when people were asking me how polls worked, and they were asking me, well, what do you mean margin of error? What do you mean a sample? How do you talk to 1,000 people and know the country? And what happened? One of the things that they were really asking when you dug a little deeper, which is, I guess, what I'm supposed to do as a pollster, is whether they knew the country as well as they thought, whether they knew how people made voting decisions as well as they had presumed or as they thought. And when I went back, and I talk about this some degree in the book, when I went, you know, you go back and you look at all that had happened in the preceding years, and you look at things like the sort of echoes, still echoing views of the economy coming out of the 2008 crash, and the loss of confidence that a lot of people had, it seemed to me, not just in whether the economy at any moment was up or down, but the way that the entire system was working. I think that when I sort of unpack that notion of change that people were expressing, that there was certainly some of that built into it, that there was certainly some of that frustration. We had seen it, too, even in the primaries leading up to it. You know, of course, there was the back and forth between Clinton and Sanders. Even in the Republican primaries, to some degree, we had seen some splits along income lines as well. And so, you know, to me, it all seemed like part and parcel of a larger dynamic that was going on. And so that's why I want to take people and say, okay, if you see a poll or you see a string of polls, when I say go beyond the horse race, I mean look at a larger sense of how people are thinking about the country, how they're thinking about the process, what kind of confidence they have in it, confidence in institutions, confidence in the political system itself, which we often find right now is very low. And I think that's more than subtext, but then that's context. And it really kind of informs all that you might be seeing. It informs what you might be seeing in the politics beyond any, you know, 1 or 2 points, this candidate or that.
Well, let's talk about that, because you make a big point in your book of not getting caught up in the horse race. As people look at these polls, who's up, who's down, you need to dig deeper and look into the context of what's happening at that given moment in time, because it's a snapshot of a moment in time. The news media has been criticized when they cover all of these political races, be they presidential or otherwise, of covering nothing but the horse race. Who's leading this week? Who's leading today? Who's down today because of whatever just happened in the news? Most people get their polling from the news media. And if the news media is just looking at who's up and who's down, how do we get the context?
Well, what I hope is that we pollsters can do a better job or do a good job of writing the stories and going beyond that, of telling you, and this everyone should demand of me and my fellow pollsters, of doing the things that I'm even trying to do here.
Yeah, but
now,
it's not just you. You may take a poll and you may give the result of that poll to producers at your network. And they decide what to do with it. They decide how to frame the story. The anchors, the reporters, they have the final word on this. How do you get control of it? How do we get control of it?
Well, I can sit for interviews like this one, and I do. And, you know, my job, and if I hope I do it well, is to then go and tell you, look, this is why. And I, you know, I like to think that when I do talk about it, or when we do talk about it, that we do give you that deeper sense of why. I mean, take for example, women are voting, especially women with college degrees, have this double-digit gender gap voting towards the Democrats, and men are going towards the Republicans. Okay, that's one step beyond, but then why is that? Well, it's my job as a pollster to ask the kinds of questions that are going to get people to reveal their thinking. So I say, okay, well, is this about the president for you, for these especially for the Democrats? And most of them say, yes, it's about the president. Well, what is it about the president that's influencing your decision-making? And we see this difference. We see where Republican women are saying, well, for me, we're supportive because, or they're saying for them, they're supportive because they like the way he manages the government. They like the policies. And for Democratic women, they're saying, well, even though some of them say the economy is good, they're saying, but we don't like how he handles himself personally. And that appears to be outweighing. That's what they're voting on. They're not voting on the economy. They're voting on how they see him handling himself personally and the culture and values they say he represents. So that's, you know, that's an example of, if I do that well, then I've given you I'm hoping you make sense of the world, I hope. I hope that I'm giving you that larger explanation. But I'm also saying,
Are we getting that from the people who report it?
Well, I can speak for myself. I can speak for, you know, what I think polling ought to be. And I think that, you know, the other part of this too, Mike, is that I totally understand that people want to look at that horse race and backfill the story from it. But I talk about this a little bit in the book too. we've gotten kind of caught up when we see the polls in these aggregations of polls where, you know, they take a whole bunch of different measurements, a whole bunch of different polls, and they combine them together. And you look at the web page and you see what that top line number is. And I mean, this speaks to your point a little bit. But I when we do that, when people do that, although they have their uses, what's happening is you've taken my poll where I've tried to ask thoughtful questions and we've tried to get beyond and understand people. I've actually talked to people. And you've taken somebody else's poll where they've asked the questions differently or a different set of questions, and you combine them together. And you, I think you lose something in that. I think you lose some of the explanation in that.
Anthony Salvanto heads elections and surveys at CBS News and last summer wrote, "Where did you get this number? A pollster's guide to making sense of the world." The conversation continues in a moment here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Hi, it's Mike Collins. Before we get to the show, I want to let you know it's WFAE's fall membership campaign. Now, don't worry, you'll hear the podcast without fundraising breaks, but I do want to encourage you to become a financial supporter of Charlotte Talks right now. $8.50 a month will help pay for the server space for us to host this podcast. It also gets you a Charlotte Talks coffee mug. So give at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000. Thank you. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and this hour we're listening back to our conversation with Anthony Salvanto, Director of Elections and Surveys at CBS News, and author of Where Did You Get This Number? A Pollster's Guide to Making Sense of the World.
We've been talking a lot about the 2016 election, and I want to move into how polls work and some other areas of discussion here in a moment. But before we do that, you just talked about how females are regarding Donald Trump and how Democratic women less favorable to Donald Trump because of his personal behavior, and Republican women more favorable because they like his policies. So you've seen this in your polling. Did polls in 2016 uncover, and did we then just ignore, the profound sense of discontent that led this election to go toward Donald Trump and led many Democrats to vote for Donald Trump?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure how many Democrats voted for Donald Trump.
Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, traditionally Democratic strongholds.
Well, right, but see, here's the difference. There's a, and this is I'm glad you raised this because it's that sort of second dimension of turnout. What we saw in county after county that was heavily Democratic was that enough Democrats stayed home that helped tilt the election.
Well, which leads to Randy's question. Randy's a listener who emailed us earlier. Was it possible that the voter turnout was affected by the constant drumbeat of landslide for Hillary, people assuming she'd win so they didn't turn out?
You know, that's a great question. It's one that we get all the time. I know this much. I know that people like to vote and do vote more in elections that they think are tight. But I don't have any direct evidence in this case that that happened. And so I think it's, like I said, I think it's a fair question, but I think it's one that, you know, it's hard to study that retroactively, but I think it would certainly be, there are studies that have been done that ask whether or not, whether the polls themselves influence the decision. And certainly, like I said, we know that people, when they feel like their vote makes a difference, that's why we see higher turnout in contested elections. But then other people come in and say, well, no, there are other correlates of a contested election. There's more money, there's more door knockers, there's more get out the vote efforts, and that's why people are more motivated to vote in those. And the other thing I know is that voting is a habit, and people do it because they've always done it. And you look at the voter files and you see that people consistently do it if they've done it before. So I think, look, I think in the 2016 case, one of the key things was people who had stayed home had past voting histories. They had come out, especially Democrats, they had voted for President Obama But obviously, I think the enthusiasm component may have affected things there.
So let's talk about how polls work, because a lot of people don't understand this. And Aaron emails, since many people misunderstand how polling works, could this be a failing of understanding of probability and statistics analysis? Probably so. I would think it plays a big role in it. But a lot of people, just very putting it very simply, don't understand how it's possible to reach a conclusion about an election or whatever you're polling about based on a tiny sample size. If you're out there polling 1,000 people and there are 134 million voters, how can you possibly determine the outcome?
Thank you for the question. And that's a big part, as you know, is a couple of chapters in the book where I think that pollsters need to, in plain language, and I certainly try to, lay this out for people, because it's a really good question and understandable why you would think that. It's not a science you can watch work in action. Mm. It's, as I often say, it might seem counterintuitive that a giant, multi-ton battleship can float, but I can watch one go by the river. I can see it. For polling, it's a little different. Pollsters always had this problem. Look, this is from an information standpoint, this is a question of representativeness. What we try to do is assemble that 1,000 or 2,000 person sample so that it is a perfect microcosm of the country. Now, the mechanism by which that works, I use the example in the book of my grandma used to whip up, put together vats of spaghetti sauce on Sundays, and she would serve everybody a bowl, and it was great. And in order to say whether or not it tasted good, which it did, by the way, in order to say whether or not it tasted good, you did not have to eat the entire vat. You could just have a bowl. That was a question. That's a question of representativeness. What was in your bowl was enough like what was back in that vat. And very specifically, the piece of garlic you got was, on the dimension of taste anyway, quite like any other piece of garlic in that pot. The meatball you got was quite like any other meatball in that pot. So what you had could be represented or represent the rest of the whole. Well, how does this work in a poll? When we talk to a Republican, we ask them questions that, even if we didn't call all the other millions and millions and millions of Republicans, they're answering that question much the same way those other Republicans would. When we talk to a Democrat, they're answering those questions the way the other Democrats would. And so they're representing the rest of the pieces, the rest of the whole. And my job is to make sure that sample is balanced, that sample is in the right proportion. But if I do that right, I think there's a certain power in that. People want to speak for themselves, and everyone is unique. Everyone is special. But in the broad brushstrokes that we use in polling, is the economy good or bad? Who are you voting for? This person or that person? Then we can get people in the poll who would answer the same way that all the people we don't talk to answer. And that's how you gather information with a sample. And that's something that that I think we need to clarify.
How do you know that people are telling you the truth? How do you know they're not fibbing to you because you're part of the evil fake news media?
Well, the answer to the first question is, lying is hard. Most people are good and decent, and lying takes a lot of work. Think about it. You sit there with a pollster, and you decide to say something you don't believe. Well, now you've got to think, what is it I should say? What is it that this pollster wants to hear? That takes work. And then you've got to say it. And then I'm going to ask you 20 other questions. So now you've got to play a role. Now you've got to lie about a whole bunch of other things. If you're pretending to be, let's say you're pretending to be a Democrat, voting for a Democratic candidate, now you've got to take the Democratic side on a whole string of issues. Otherwise, it doesn't hold up. And then think of the basic answer. Why would you spend 10 minutes taking one of my surveys just for the sake of lying all the way through it? When we look at people's answers in the surveys, what we find, in fact, is that they're remarkably consistent. They would have to fall off somewhere. When you're a Democrat, you're answering the Democratic way throughout. When you're a Republican, same thing. And so I think that what's more likely to happen is either you hang up, in which case hopefully we'll go out and find someone else who wants to take it. But also, sometimes people say they're unsure. And in those cases, I think we have to take them at their word. And we have to say, and a pollster should express to you, look, there's some uncertainty in this. People are saying that they don't know, they don't have an opinion on something. And so let's take them at their word on it.
A lot of people, and I'm one of them, don't answer the phone. I don't take phone calls if I don't recognize the number or if I don't like what's on the caller ID. So is that making your job? Because I know at CBS you do these polls, and they're call-out polls in many cases. Is it making your job almost impossible or certainly more difficult than it was, say, 10 years ago?
It is more difficult, and you're exactly correct. Our response rates on the phone have gone down over the years. We have to dial, when we do phone polls, a whole lot more numbers than we did 10, 20 than they did 30 years ago. That's before my time. But, that just to me, it means you need a more careful pollster. It's become more expensive to do. But it also means pollsters have to keep up with changing technology. Over the years, when people went to telephones as opposed to, pollsters going door to door, pollsters went to telephones. And then they moved to cell phones. We moved to cell phones. We call mostly cell phones in our phone polls now, that we dial a lot of them. And now we've moved online. And by and large, the bulk of the interviews you see from me now are done online. And that's still with a representative sample that's put together. But people can take that.
How does that work? Do you send out an email to people asking them to participate? Is that how that works? Or do you direct people to the CBS website to take the poll?
No. You never want people to go straight in, because then you could skew the results toward people who are extra passionate about one thing or another. What we do is, with the help of we use YouGov. We work with YouGov on this. And they assemble millions of people on a panel who have agreed to participate possibly in the surveys. And those samples are put together such that the composition of them matches, if it's a national poll, the national demographics of the electorate or of the nation. Then they get sent the survey.
I also wanted to ask about this, because you say that those who are more difficult to reach are more mobile, are often lower socioeconomic status, and tend to be younger. Well, if you called me, you couldn't reach me, and I'm none of those. So how did you reach that conclusion?
Well, we've looked at this extensively. I mean, pollsters, we tend to be a bit of a fastidious bunch. We want to correct ourselves if we think something's off. And so we've gone back and we've looked at the phone numbers that we've dialed, and we look at the people who don't take the polls. And what we want to avoid is always systematically missing one kind of person. You're exactly right that younger people, for whatever reason, they're busy, they've got other things on their minds, are harder to get. So it just takes us more effort to go find them. But, back to the earlier point about a sample, Mike, I've got to go out and find someone like you. And, it may not be, of course, exactly like you. They may not be on the radio or have your particular upbringing or background, but they might answer the questions the same way that you would. Does it take me longer and more effort to go make sure that I find somebody like you? Yes, it does.
You talked about how the way polls are being conducted has changed because technology has changed. In social media and in the world of the internet, there are companies like Google, like Apple, like Facebook, who know everything about us. They know our taste. They can predict from what they know about us what we'll buy next online. They know us better than we know ourselves. It's a remarkable power. Could they predict that I will or will not vote for a certain candidate? And could you use that technology as a pollster to be even more accurate than you are now?
Well, I think this raises a really interesting question, and we may be sitting here in a couple of years talking about another new kind of or different kind of public opinion research. I don't know what they do now, but I don't use that kind of thing here. I like to talk to people or have our folks talk to people. And I think that people can still do the best job of expressing for themselves what they're doing and thinking. That's part of my job. But look, you cannot discount the fact, as you raise, that there are more and more, you know, trails for all of us as we go online, as we post things and so on social media. And what those algorithms do or say, that could be a really, really interesting subject.
Anthony Salvato has been our guest, director of polling and surveys at CBS News and author of Where Did You Get This Number? A Pollster's Guide to Making Sense of the World. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.